gorgeous night out. Like, I'm really, really happy about the weather right now. I thought it was going to be a little bit warmer, and I should have worn shoes because my feet are kind of chilly. So anyway, I'm going to ramble for a few minutes because I like to cut the time down. All right, and we're good. So like I said, my name is Megan, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, guys. Lauren, thank you very much for asking me to come out here and speak. It's always an honor and a privilege when you're asked to do anything for AA, because AA is the only reason that I'm here today. You know what I mean? I'm sure some of you guys can relate. If I had done the things that I was doing, there is a very good chance that I wouldn't be standing here today. But God and AA intervened at the perfect time, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But let me start where I like to start. I have a sobriety date. I've been sober since August 22nd, 2009. I have a home group. We meet in Ben Salem on Tuesday nights. Actually, we just moved. Long story. And while I don't have an AA sponsor at the time, I do have a spiritual advisor in my life that I check in with weekly, and a group of women who help guide me spiritually as well. So where to start? At the beginning, I guess. So the big book tells me that I have one really simple job when I come up here, and it's to tell you guys what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I had that kind of messed up for the first few years of my sobriety. I thought it said I have to tell you guys what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And the fact of the matter is, I can tell you all of the circumstances that revolved around my drinking and my sobriety, and you might not be able to relate to them. But if I tell you guys what I felt like when I was drinking, and what I feel like today, you might be able to relate a little bit more, because I'm pretty sure that none of our stories are exactly the same. And I was taught when I came in to find something to help me relate to the speaker. Because if I can't relate to the person who's up here, I'm going to tune out and I'm going to not listen to anything. So let me tell you guys what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I grew up in, like, the perfect house. My parents are still together after, like, 30-some years of marriage. They're adorable people. They still dress in couples costumes every single Halloween. Like, it's a little sick. It's ruined my idea of relationships. Like, nothing is ever going to be as awesome as my parents' relationship. They're just, like, the two most amazing people. My father volunteers, my mother volunteers, they make meals for shut-ins, like they're just good, solid people. They're not the kind of people like me who need a book to tell them how to live life right. I've got two awesome brothers. One of my brothers, he had a drinking problem, but you know what? He's not really one of us. He doesn't have to go through this work on a daily basis to keep sober. One day he just decided to put it down and he picked up a drink again once. My little brother got pissed off at him, and he put it back down again. Like, he just doesn't have that thing in his brain that I have. So perfect family. My parents are great people. Beautiful house out in the suburbs, picket fence, all the whole nine, you know what I mean? And I don't say that to brag or anything. I just want to let you guys know that I am not a victim of circumstance. Like, if you judged me by the way that I was raised, like, there's absolutely no reason that I should have become an alcoholic. So I grew up in this great family. Anything that I needed, I had. Anything that I wanted, I got. But the problem with that was every time I got something I wanted, I immediately wanted something more. Like, I wanted something different. And, like, from a very, very early age, I just remember being terrified of everything. And I remember getting sober, and a few years into my sobriety, I said to my mom one day, I said, "Mom, did you know that my entire life was ruled by fear?" She looked at me and she said, "Megan, you used to wake us up in the middle of the night to make sure your father and I were still alive. Yes, I know that you used to read first aid manuals just in case anything happened." She said, "At 6 years old, you knew where you were going to go if a tornado was coming down the street." I was a weird little kid. Just a quick story about how weird I was. So after my youngest brother was born, someone gave him, like, you know those big giant teddy bears? Someone bought him one of those. So I wanted it, so immediately I took it. because that's what I do. And I would sleep with this bear on the outside edge of my bed because in my 7-year-old mind, when the murderer was going to break into my house, because that was just inevitable, when the murderer was going to break into my house, he was going to come into my room and he would stab the bear instead of me and I would survive. Like, that's messed up, guys. That's really messed up. Kids shouldn't think like that. So I was afraid of everything. I was afraid of everyone. Honestly, as long as I was in my room with my books and my toys, I was a happy kid. The only time that I could be around people and be all right with myself was when I was playing sports. So I made my life revolve around that. I played sports all through high school. I played lacrosse. I, to this day, absolutely love lacrosse. I still coach. I played in college. It's awesome. We'll get back to that, but just in the back of your brain, remember, Megan loves lacrosse. Check. Happiest time she's ever had. Check. Remember that. We'll get to it. So, those were the only times that I actually felt comfortable was for the 90 minutes or so that I was out on the field playing a game. And I didn't, like, I would go to parties. I had friends. I just didn't really know how to talk to people. I'm still super socially awkward, as any of my friends can attest. It's gotten better, but I'm still the kind of person who, like, if I'm not okay, I'll just leave. Like, I Irish goodbye with the best of them. But look at me. I should be able to Irish goodbye. I'm like 100% Irish. I'm basically a leprechaun. true story. So, felt super awkward my entire life. And here's the thing, like, I was a good kid. I was. I went to private school. I grew up going to church with my family every Sunday, super active in school. I, like, good kid. None of my friends drank. We went to a Catholic private school, so all we heard about was how bad it was when you drank. So none of us drank. And also, there was also this little voice in the back of my head, that was my dad. My grandfather was an alcoholic. He was one of us. He found AA while my dad was still a kid and he died with 30 years sober. But I knew that thing was in my family. Like I knew that there was always that possibility of alcoholism. So I stayed away. It just wasn't really a big deal. None of my friends drank. It was fine. Fast forward to senior prom. My friends and I, we go to the prom, we go back to our friend's house, someone has vodka. So, you know what, I've waited long enough, I'm gonna try it. And right from Jump Street, I didn't drink like the rest of my friends. I didn't go like super wild, but after the first couple of drinks, the girls I was hanging out with, they started to feel it, so they were like, you know what, I'm gonna slow down. After the next couple of drinks, the guys I was hanging out with, they started pretending that they were keeping up with me, but they had actually just switched to like regular orange juice because they didn't want to be outdrank by me. Because again, look at me, I'm not that big. I'm really not intimidating. But I started feeling like that little release, and I liked that feeling because for the first time in my entire life, I could sit down and have a conversation with someone. I wasn't super afraid of what you were thinking of me. I wasn't super afraid of what people over in the corner were saying about me, because that was always my biggest fear. If you were sitting over in that corner, I knew you were talking about me. Truth is, I'm really not that important, or that interesting for that matter. So like for the first time in my life, it was like I was stuck at the bottom of like the 12-foot pool, and you know, like when you're swimming and you're swimming and you're swimming and you're almost out of air and then your head pops through the surface and you take that. That's how I felt the first time I drank. It was like I was able to breathe for the first time. And I didn't like lose it after that. I didn't drink every single day after that, but that entire summer, you better believe that every opportunity that I got, I drank. And it wasn't, like I said, every other day. I didn't find myself down at Kensington and Somerset the next week, you know? Like, it was just, I liked it. I knew that I liked it. So I go away to school in the fall, and my first two orders of business when I step foot on my college campus is to join the lacrosse team and to Rush a Sorority, because in every single college movie I've ever seen in my entire life, the two groups that party the hardest are the athletes and the Greeks. So I figured, if I joined both of those groups, I insured myself a party for the next 4 years. Turns out I actually insured myself a party for the next 7 years, but that's another story, and we're going to get to that. So I drank at every opportunity I could get, you know? And by joining those two groups, like, the opportunities were plenty. And for the first, like, couple of years, I managed. I was actually, like, pretty good at being functional. I mean, and by functional, I mean I'd show up to class. I'd still be in a blackout, but I'd be there. I'd take tests and pass them, but I wouldn't actually remember taking them. And the worst part, the best worst part about it was that spring, the spring of my freshman year, like I said, I joined the lacrosse team, and somehow or another, during spring break, it snowed. We found ourselves at this hole-in-the-wall bar in Westchester, and I was, like, 18 years old. I don't even know why they thought it was a good idea to serve me, because I still look 12. And this was, like, 15 years ago. I don't know why the bartender thought I was over 21, but he did. And, like, that was, like, the worst best thing that's ever happened to me. Because the minute I found out that I could get into that hole-in-the-wall bar, I was there, like, every day. The problem with that was the bartender who knew me, he had that weird 8 a.m. until 2 p.m. shift. So if I wanted to drink, I had to get to the bar at 8 a.m. And I didn't really see that as a problem. I started thinking that it was a problem that my friends didn't want to go to the bar at 8 o'clock in the morning with me. They had important things like class to handle. But it was like I was in my glory. I got to be friends with the bartenders. We were so good friends. And then I remember going up to the bar. It was the next year I was a sophomore, so still totally not old enough to be in the bar. But I remember walking up to the bar one evening, and as I was reaching for the door handle, one of the girls, one of the seniors on my lacrosse team, she grabbed the back of my shirt, and she pulled me back, and she whispered in my ear, "They know." And it was absolutely heartbreaking. Like, I started crying because that just complicated my drinking so much, because now I was going to have to find someone who was 21. I was going to have to give them all of my money, because drinking at the bar was a lot cheaper than any kind of beer distributor. I was going to have to give them extra money for doing me a favor. Like, it really threw a wrench in my plans, I'll tell you. And right around this time, so, like I said, favorite thing in the world, playing lacrosse. Still one of my favorite things in the world. Right around this time, we had this thing for lacrosse. It was called the 48-hour rule. That meant 48 hours before a game, we had to cease all alcoholic consumption. And by my sophomore year in college, 48 hours was just way too long for me to stay sober. So I quit. Just gave it up. I came up with this really brilliant plan. I was going to join the rugby team because, and this is my thinking, it's very logical, the rugby team only had a 24-hour rule, and their coach bought them beer right after the game. Because I don't know if you guys have ever watched a rugby match, but basically, like, again, look at me. I could actually be picked up and thrown across the field by some of the girls that I played against. So it hurts. It hurts all over. So what you do is you drink immediately after the game to start dulling that pain, and then you deal with the bruises the next day. So our coach would buy us drinks right after, like, on the field. It was perfect, except for the fact that by the end of my junior year, 24 hours, way too long to stay sober. I should also mention, right around this time was when my sorority kicked me out for excessive drinking. Do you know how hard it is to get kicked out of a sorority for excessive drinking? I have only met one other woman in my entire life who has gotten kicked out of her sorority for the same thing. And, surprise, surprise, I met her in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My friends, to this day, make fun of me for drinking that badly that I get kicked out of my sorority. New plan. Not playing lacrosse, not playing rugby, got kicked out of the sorority, but I'm friends with all of these athletes, so I'm going to party with the soccer players this night, the basketball players this night, Theta Chi on that night. I just decided that I was going to party with different people every night of the week. That way, brilliant. No one knows exactly how much I'm drinking because the soccer players don't talk to the football players, so they're not going to know that I was able to hang with the linebackers on Friday night. Again, this all seemed totally logical in my mind. So, fast forward to, I think I was about 4.5 years into my college career when, my parents, so I neglected to tell my parents that I was not actually going to class and passing classes until, I was driving home from Westchester on Christmas Eve. My parents thought I was graduating like the week after that, and my car dies on the turnpike. So as my father is picking me up on the side of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, I decide that on Christmas Eve, this was a great time to tell him, by the way, I'm not graduating. And I still have like 2 more semesters to go. And he looked at me and he said, you know what, let's go back to Westchester. We're going to grab all of your things and you're just going to come home because we're not doing this anymore. So I moved back to Langhorne, and I got a job. And I don't know if you guys are like me, but I can find my people wherever I go. Like, I can sniff them out. And very, very quickly, I found my people, even out here in the suburbs. And I started hanging out with my people out here. And while I had drank a lot in college, and I had started, you know, doing things, other things that I didn't ever see myself doing, when I moved back home, that's when things started getting, like, really bad. And within the course of, like, 9 months, I had a job, I had a car, I had a place to live. Within the course of 9 months, my car got repoed. I lost my job. I don't even understand how they kept me for as long as they did. And my parents only vaguely knew that I was alive because every once in a while I'd call them to get money from them. So, like I said, this was about 9 months. And right around that 9 month mark, I remember going down to Philadelphia one day and I was meeting up with some friends of mine from college and I didn't think that I was that bad at that point in time. And, my friend Greta sat me down at one point in the day, and I still only have vague flashes of this day, but I remember her sitting me down and looking at me and saying, like, what's going on? You look like you're dying. And that was a little bit of a wake-up call, and I remember getting home the next day, and as it turns out, those people that I had found, they wound up going to jail. So that was another little wake-up call, and I had this epiphany. I had a drug problem. But I was 24 years old and you could not tell me that I have an alcohol problem. So, in my mind, here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna go up to Massachusetts. I have an aunt and uncle that I can stay with. I'm going to go up there for 2 weeks. I'm gonna get everything out of my system and I'm gonna be able to drink like a normal person. So I do that. And I come back down and I'm just drinking. And slowly but surely on paper, my life gets a little bit better. My parents invite me back into their home. I get my car back. I get a new job. I start being welcomed around my friends again. And I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this, but when things start going really well for me, that's when I can do those things again, but I can do them differently. Like, I can do drugs like a lady this time. I know where I went wrong. I can beat the game. So something happened to me and like I stubbed my toe and I was like, you know what could fix this? I know what can fix this. I know what takes away pain really well. So, we all know how that turns out, right? And here's the thing, like, I managed for about a week, and then after about a week and a half, I was spending my entire paycheck on my extracurricular activities. And, you know, by 3 weeks, my paycheck's my paycheck's not cutting it. So I start taking money from work because, honestly, if my bosses knew what a good job I was doing, they'd probably be paying me extra money anyway. So I was totally entitled to the money that I was stealing from work. They just didn't understand what a good employee I was. They might not have understood that because I was always late coming back from lunch. I was sick a lot. I just didn't do work. I played on the internet a lot. Like, I'd just read. And yeah, but in my mind, I still deserved this extra compensation. Here's the thing though. Sometimes they catch you doing that. And, here's the other thing. I was working at a bank when I was doing that. So they, yeah. Yes, guys, they don't like it when you steal money from the bank. They don't like it. They actually bring the FBI in. True story. So, let me just, okay, cool. We're almost at halftime. We're getting to Megan's moment of clarity, I promise. I try to get sober by halftime, and we're almost there. So, the bank brings in these gentlemen, and they bring me back to the other room, and my boss is there, and my boss says, "Excuse me, gentlemen, let me talk to her for a minute." And my boss lets the two FBI agents out of the room, and she says to me, "Listen, I'm gonna give you one chance. If you can get me the money back by tomorrow morning, we will not press charges." So I go to my parents because every single time that I've ever been in trouble, they've been there for me. Like I said, my parents are amazing people. They really, really are. Here's just a little, I just want to give you guys just a little snapshot of how delusional I was at this point in time. I was clearly like strung out to no end, and I thought no one noticed, because I always think I'm much better at hiding things than I really am. I went to my parents and I said, "Hey mom, hey dad, can I borrow a couple of $1,000? I accidentally gave it away to a customer and now the FBI is involved." And I believed that they believed me. When really, they didn't believe me. They knew exactly what had happened to that money, but they also didn't want to see me get into any trouble. So they helped me out and I was able to avoid any kind of charges. So that happened. I got caught stealing from the bank on August 2nd of 2009. And like I said at the beginning of my story, my sobriety date is August 22nd of 2009. So you can imagine what my life was like for those 20 days. I didn't have any source of income besides what I could take, which was basically anything that wasn't nailed down. I found someone who would buy anything. Like, I'm just really resourceful when it comes to that. I was just a mess. By the end of those 20 days, no one wanted me around. And so that brings us to August 21st of 2009. It was a Friday night. It was like that weird misty rain where it's kind of creepy, but it's not really raining. And, I remember it was like 9 o'clock at night. And honestly, at that point in time, I wasn't drinking or doing anything else for fun anymore. I was doing it so I could go to sleep and like just wake up in the morning. I couldn't go to sleep without some kind of substance in my system. And here's like the even crazier part. I remember every night before I went to bed, I would pray to God to not kill me in my sleep. And every single morning when I woke up, I would ask God why he didn't kill me in my sleep. Like, that's a terrible place to live. Not knowing whether you wanted to live or die. And that's where I was. Like, I remember crying myself to sleep, and I remember crying myself awake, too. It's not fun. I'm sure some of you guys can relate to that feeling. But that was, like, my jumping-off point, you know? So August 21st, 2009, Friday night, I have no money left. I have nothing. Like, I've sold everything of any value. I've done all kinds of weird things to get money. I cleaned houses for a minute, but it was just real weird. So I get this really good idea, because you guys have heard some of my really good ideas so far. Like, they're really on point. I get this awesome idea that I'm going to sneak downstairs. I'm going to take my dad's ATM card out. I'm going to just go and take some money out. Well, I'm going to take a little bit more than I really need, because I'm going to need it eventually anyway. And I'm going to go get what I need to get just so I can go to sleep. And I'm going to put money back in his account before he notices. I don't know where I thought I was getting this money. Like, I don't know where I was getting this money to pay him back. Again, delusional thinking. I was a crazy person. Also, sidebar, my father's an accountant. He checks his bank balances literally every single day. Like, he still has an old school check ledger. Like, he is, that, right? So he knows where, like, every single cent he has. I don't know. Like I said, crazy pants. I do what I gotta do. I go home. I go to sleep. Like, that's all I needed to do. I wake up the next morning to a knock on my door, and it's my father, because he checks his bank balance every single morning. And I get up, and I say, hey, what's up? And he goes, I just want to check. Did you happen to take my ATM card and take out some money from my account last night? And I said, absolutely not. How could you think that of me? And he looked at me, right? And he looked at me, and I'll never forget the look in his eyes, because it was just pure sadness, because he knew that I took it. So he looked at me and he said, oh, all right, okay. And he turned and he walked away, and I laid back down on my bed, and that's when my wheels start going, and I start thinking to myself, well, he's going to ask everyone else in the house. No one's going to cop to taking the card. He's going to go to the bank. He's going to ask the bank tellers to see the video. He's going to see my face on the video, and he's going to be even more pissed off than he already is. So I might as well just go and fess up to it, because what's the worst that's going to happen? They're going to slap me on the wrist and send me on my way, and I might be able to finagle another, $20 out of them for gas. So I go downstairs and I say to my dad, you know what, Dad? I forgot. I did take money. And he looks at me and goes, you forgot? I said, yeah, I forgot. And he goes, we need to talk. I know what's going on here. I've seen it before. And he tells this story now that he knew when to send me to rehab when he had... Do you guys have seen, like, the giant water jugs full of, like, pennies, right? Well, that was my hustle for a little bit. Every day I'd just take a few more. Like, just $5 here, $10 there. He knew it was time for me to go to rehab when there was no pennies left in the bucket. Like, and, yeah, he thinks he's really funny, but whatever. So, I love my father. He's a great guy. So, he sits me down and he says, listen, you're killing yourself. We've been watching this go on for years. And your mother and I can't take it anymore. So I'm going to give you two options. He said, one, you can go upstairs, you can pack your bags, and you can get out of my house, because honestly, I don't want to watch it anymore. Or two, you can bring your laptop down here. You can find a place to go, and we'll support you if you want to actually try to get sober. Because like I said, my father... For someone who's not an alcoholic, he truly believes in the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sure throughout my entire drinking career, he probably tried to nudge me in that direction more than once. But he also knows that you can't force someone into sobriety. So he's great. He really is. I love my dad. He's just a really cool guy. So I got the computer, and I looked up this place, and honestly, do you want to know how Megan picks a rehab? I picked a rehab based on the fact that a friend of mine went into this certain rehab with a heroin problem, and he came out just popping pills. So I figured that they've got to be able to teach me something in there. Like, I'm going to be able to come out and drink like a normal person, because my cousin's wedding is in a week, and I need to be there. I need to be there. Yo, the show cannot go on without me. So I get myself set up at this place, and I remember walking in, and I sat in my counselor's office the first day, and I said to her, I said, listen, I have to be out of here in a week because I have a wedding to go to, and they cannot have this wedding without me. I've been looking forward to my cousin's special day for a long time. You don't understand. This is my special day, too. I wasn't in the wedding. Like, I didn't even have a dress for it. So she said, you know what, let's talk about it in like a day or two. And I fought tooth and nail for the first 2 days that I was there. That I was, all I needed to do, I was like a car. I just needed to go in and get a tune-up, get all of this stuff out of me, and I was going to be able to drink like a normal person. Which I don't know where I got that idea. Literally from the very first time I drank, I never drank like a normal person. But I was convinced that that's what was going to happen. So I remember laying in my bed that first night, and I was crying because I didn't know how I got there. I was a good kid. Like, I was an athlete. I was on a roll, you know? Like, I was a good kid. I went to private school. How did I wind up in a rehabilitation center? So I cried myself to sleep the first couple of days that I was there, and then I remember walking into my counselor's office the third day that I was there, and I sat down in her chair, and I looked at her, and I said, you know what? My decision-making skills have not exactly been on par lately, so maybe I should do what you're telling me to do now. And that led to me being in rehab for, I was there for like about 28 days. And things started happening when I was in that rehab. For example, I had this counselor, and she was not one of us. And you know, have you guys ever talked to, like, an alcohol counselor who's not an alcoholic? Like, you just don't believe anything they say. Like, they don't know you. She got sick, like, the first week that I was there, and they replaced her with a woman who was one of us. And she spoke my language. And she offered me small kindnesses. For example, like, during meditation time, I was a mess. Like, I couldn't sit still. I saw people, like, they were taking naps and stuff. I didn't sleep, like, for my first entire year of sobriety. So she would let me come up to her office, and she would talk to me and stuff like that. And she gave me three major pieces of advice that shaped the rest of my sobriety. She said, Megan, when you get out of this place, do three things. She said, go to a meeting, get a sponsor, make sure that sponsor takes you through the big book, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as outlined through the big book. And those were the three things that I took away from that. Like, we went to a lot of lectures in rehab, like about the family dynamic and about like triggers and super fun stuff like that. But those were the real deal, those three pieces of advice. So I get out of rehab a couple days later, and I find myself in a meeting that first night, and I'm actually more of a crazy person when you take alcohol out of my system, and so I'm sitting in this meeting, and I was super, like, weirded out. I thought I was in some kind of cult meeting, because when I walked in, there were just, like, a table full of, like, bald white guys with all of like these gnarly tattoos, and I was like, I'm in a cult. Like, the what's happening right now? I don't understand it. But I sat down, and I kept my mouth shut, and again, I'm a crazy person. And I remember this guy coming in, and have you ever hated someone just by looking at them? Like, right off the bat, hated them. This kid walks in, he had this jet black hair and these tattoos and these piercings. I hated him with every ounce of my being. He was high-fiving people and laughing and hugging people. And all I could think to myself was, what a poser, who does this kid think he is? And this story goes over a lot better when I'm down by me, because it turns out that like 8 years later, this guy is my best friend in the entire world. Who I love, absolutely, like, he's just the best person, and I laugh so hard because I absolutely hated him so much. Like, every ounce of my being just hated how happy he was. And that's the thing, like, I hated him because he looked so happy, and I really had this belief that happiness and sobriety were two mutually exclusive ideas, and you could not have them together. So, I stuck it out, I stayed in that meeting, I heard about this picnic that they were having that weekend, and I was like, whatever, what else am I gonna do? So I go to this picnic, and the woman that's speaking at this picnic is, she's 4 months sober, and that just blew my mind. Because I didn't understand how you could get 4 weeks sober, let alone 4 months sober. And, her story, something about it touched me right here, and, After the picnic, I'm sure some of you guys have had to ask someone to be your sponsor, and you know how, like, you get that weird, like, nervous, I'm asking you to the prom, what if you say no type feeling? I had that feeling, so I didn't say anything until she had gotten, like, probably from here to the church, to her car, getting into her car, and I ran. I sprinted. There are two guys that were at that picnic that day that still make fun of me for that. I ran as fast as I could after her, and she was an upstanding member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she agreed to sponsor me, and she said, "Do you have a big book?" I said, "Yeah, they gave me one in the rehab." She said, "Good, go home. Read the doctor's opinion and the first chapter, and I'll meet you down at 4th and Lombard, which is where the underground is held, Tuesday evening, and we'll talk about what you read." And slowly but surely, we went through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous together, and she led me through my steps. And I'll just, like I said, briefly go over them because I am running out of time. I usually get really nervous about this thing, like speaking for an hour, and then I remember I'm an alcoholic, and honestly, I can talk about myself for as long as you give me. Really, I can talk about myself for days if you let me. I'm going to try not to, though. So we went through the big book, and, you know, she asked me questions, and she asked me things like, "Do you believe in a power greater than yourself?" And here's the thing, like, I never didn't believe in a power greater than myself. I just felt like I was too insignificant for anything bigger than me to care about me. So I didn't really have a hard time getting my head around that piece. And when we knelt down to say the third step prayer, all she said was like, "Listen, you're just making a decision right now to go through the rest of these steps." And, I didn't have any real, like, solid white light experiences through my first couple of months of sobriety, except, like, once I stopped trying to micromanage literally everything that happened in my life, like, things just started happening. Like, it was very, very weird. There's something to this, like, relinquishing control thing that really, I was able to see it very, very early on. Because I don't know about you guys, but I love to control, like, literally everything. That's why I became a teacher. Like, these kids have to do what I say all day long. It's awesome. It's so, you're not making your letters right. Do it like this. It's so cool. So awesome. I love controlling the little ones. They're just really fun. So I love to control things. But I learned early on that I had to take my hands off the reins a little bit. So we go through 1, 2, and 3, and then she gives me some papers, and she said, "All right, it's time to write a 4-step list." And I was like, "Wait, what? I've heard about these things. These are super scary." She said, "No, they're not. Just do what the book tells you." So I did, and I started writing one night, and I didn't stop until I was finished. And then we had to go through a 5th step, and I heard even more scary things about that. She said, "It's not scary. You literally just have to tell me what you wrote, and we're going to talk about it." So we did that. And it wasn't scary. And you know what? That night I went home, and I slept better than I had in, like, months. Because I had finally, like, gotten all of these resentments and all of these fears and all of this stuff out. I will keep a resentment inside of me until it literally eats away at me. Like, I've made myself physically ill over resentments. So we read 6 and 7, and we talked about character defects. And to this day, there are some that they come and they go, and they come and they go. And I just have to remind myself to be willing to let go of them when it's right. And, you know, we made up an amends list, and I set out to make amends. And I have a little bit of time, so I'm going to tell you two really cool amends stories. The thing about amends, at least for me, is, like, there were some that I thought were going to be super easy that crushed me, and there were some that I thought were going to be so difficult that I was so scared of doing them, and when I came out of it, it was one of the best experiences of my life. So I mentioned that I had my cousin's wedding when I was in rehab. I didn't make it, because I was in rehab, and I went to make amends to her because it was a big day, and I missed it because of things of my own doing. And I honestly thought that amends was going to be a breeze. It was her wedding day. I really honestly didn't think that she would even notice that I was gone. So I sat down with her and I said, listen, Jack, like, I was wrong. Like, I missed your wedding. I know what a big deal that was. And she looked at me and she said, but do you? And I said, yeah, it was a big deal. She goes, no, Megan, I cried the entire morning of my wedding because you weren't there. And like that absolutely crushed me. But the cool part about the amends process is the next thing I got to say was, how can I make things right between us? And you better believe that she made me watch all 8 hours of her uncut wedding footage. 8 hours. 8 hours. It's not even fun when it's the cut version of the wedding footage. But here's the thing. She didn't do that out of malice. She really wanted me to feel as if I was there. And it's still a running joke in my family. Every once in a while, she'll say to me, like, remember at my wedding? Oh, no, you don't. You weren't there. But, like, that was one that I thought was going to be super easy, and it wound up, it really took a toll on me. But, again, I was able to make that relationship right again, and now I'm so close with her. Like, she's got 3 kids, all under the age of 6, and I watch them all the time. And that's incredible. She actually leaves me in charge of them. Like, I'm responsible for those 3 lives when she's not around. And I adore it. They're great little people. And then let me tell you one more amends story really quick. About a year into my sobriety, I got a phone call from Bucks County, and I had applied for a job. I honestly don't even remember applying for it, but they had selected my application, and they were looking into hiring me for their emergency services. So I had gone, I took a test, I passed the test, and they called me one day, and they said, all right, you passed this test. We are now going to move on to your employment history part, the portion where we check your employment history. And I was like, okay, I robbed the bank. I wonder if that's going to come up. So I said, oh, okay, and I hung up. And I immediately go into meltdown mode because that's my default. I melt down very easily. And I call my sponsor and I say, listen, Kathy, what am I supposed to do? I know I need to make this amends. This woman, my boss, is on my amends list, but if I make it right now, is it going to be purely out of selfish reasons? And back and forth and back and forth, and I'm calling and texting, and like everyone in sobriety, I need everyone's opinions because I can't settle on one person's opinion. If one person's opinion is good, 10 people's opinions has got to be better, right? So I talk to a bunch of people, and we settle on the fact that I've now at least become willing to make this amends. And I don't know about you guys, but I am a firm believer in the fact that once I decide to do the right thing, the universe starts to rearrange itself to meet my needs. So later on that day, I'm driving home from work, and a friend of mine calls, and she says, hey, I'm heading over to the hospital. A friend of ours was there living out his last hours because of this disease. We were getting ready for them to pull the plug on him. And she said, listen, I'm going to go over. A bunch of us are going to be over there. Do you want to go? And, like, I'll buy you dinner. And I love hospital food. So absolutely. I love food when it's free, especially. So I meet her over there. And I'm walking up to the hospital. And as I'm walking out, I see 2 of my friends from the fellowship walking. I'm walking in. They're walking out. I stop to talk to these 2 guys. And as I'm talking to them, I feel a tap on my shoulder. And I look around. And it's my boss, who I haven't seen in a year and a half. Right? Like, that's pretty cool. So my 2 friends to this day, they remember the look on my face, and I kind of just went like, I get it. Okay. So I say, hey, Joan, while I have you here, can I have a minute of your time? And I was able to make an amends to this woman that day. Like, that's pretty cool. And that's like my big amends story. So let's move on. I have if you want to hear more of my amends stories, I've got plenty of them if you want to talk to me at the meeting. So I continue to make my amends, and I continue to make my relationships right with other people, and I proceed to continue on to 10, 11, and 12. And I love 10, 11, and 12, and they make me feel so good. So good that, like I've said before, when something makes me feel really, really good, I stop doing it. Like, I just stopped doing it. I don't know why. It made me feel so good that I stopped. So I started resting on my laurels, and at about a year and a half sober, I found myself on a friend's bathroom floor because I wanted to kill myself. And luckily, it was a friend of mine who's from the rooms, and she cleaned me up, and she sat me up, and she said, "I have a quick question for you. When's the last time that you went through to work?" And I said, "Well, it's been a while." She goes, I think maybe you and I should sit down, and we should start going through this stuff again." And I took that, like I said, once I decide to start doing the right thing, the universe rearranges itself to meet my needs. And so I started going through the work again. And that time I actually did learn my lesson. And to this day, 10, 11, and 12 are like the highlights of my life. I absolutely adore practicing that stuff on a daily basis. And that's going to lead me into my prayer and meditation piece. Because like I've tried, like, when I first came in, I told you, I couldn't meditate. Like, I am an anxious person by default. Like, I've just recently found out, like, that doesn't have anything to do with my alcoholism. I do have anxiety, and I see someone about it now, because I've gone through this work, and it still hasn't gone away. So I see someone for my anxiety now. But anyway, I couldn't sit still. So luckily, early on in sobriety, I had this sponsor, and she introduced me to this entire world of meditation and prayer and different ways to do it. And she gave me good ideas. Like, I run. She said, "You know what? Like, maybe run without your headphones on and meditate that way. It's called movement, like movement meditation. Go to yoga. Try to meditate that way." And I've tried all of these different avenues to spirituality. And that's honestly my favorite part of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that no one tells me that there's an exact way that you need to do it. They just want you to do it some way. So eventually I found my way back to the church that I grew up in, in a weird series of events where I became very close with two members of the church, one being a Catholic priest who to this day is one of my best friends. I started going back to church, and now I volunteer there, and it's super great. And that's the way that I connect to my higher power, because I don't think I mentioned a lot of it, but really, I had absolutely nothing to do with my getting sober. I didn't. If it was up to me, I never would have gotten sober. I was just surviving, but I had no desire to change my way of life. I remember applying for jobs, and I needed to stay around the Philadelphia area because I was so scared that wherever I would go, I wouldn't be able to find what I needed. So I love steps 10, 11, and 12 because they keep me in that spiritual arena. And I try to practice these principles in all of my affairs, and I just try to be a good person. I said at the beginning that my parents, they volunteer and they make food for shut-ins. And recently I have a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, who was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she and her family are going through this whole ordeal. And my friends and I now, we make dinners for them once a week. And that in itself is like, it just makes me really, really, it makes me feel good inside to not be thinking about myself all the time. And, that's basically where this entire thing has gotten me to. I don't think about myself constantly. I believe in a power greater than myself. I want to help other people. Like, I'm not gonna lie, my first thought in the morning is about myself, but like, very quickly I think about other people too. Sobriety has been really good to me. I've done things that I never thought were possible. A few years ago, I was just unhappy with where I was in my life, and, luckily, like, I spend a lot of time with my friends and my family these days, and they told me that I should go back to school, and I went back to school, and I got my master's of education, and now I teach. That's amazing. Like, people actually trust me with their kids. Like, that's insane. I wasn't even to be trusted with myself. Like, it was hard enough just keeping me alive for 6 hours. Now I've got 36-year-olds that I have to keep alive and teach them things, too. Like, that's a big deal. I've done like crazy cool things. Like, I ran 2 half marathons. I've gone on some really cool trips, and I know how to like be a friend today. I know how to be a sister today. I know how to be a daughter today. I know how to be a cousin today. I have this little cousin, his name is Quinn, he's 6, and his mom texted me last week, and she said, Quinn just started talking about you and how he wants you to come and visit because you're his favorite cousin. Said, does Quinn understand that we are actually not related? Like, we're not really blood related. I'm not his cousin. She goes, yeah, you're still his favorite cousin. So like things like that, super cool. So I've rambled on for about as much time as I should. But if you're new, talk to some people after the meeting. Find someone who's willing to sponsor you. Find someone who wants to take you through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know it's changed my life, and I know of a lot of other people who have done the exact same work and they've experienced the exact same results. So there's gotta be something that's working here. Like it's worth a shot. Even if you don't really believe that it's gonna work for you, like honestly, you have nothing to lose. Like if you're coming in here the way that I came in here, you have nothing to lose. So that's all I got. Thanks, guys.